ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The writer Zadie Smith is my guest on Conversations today. I spoke with Zadie from a BBC studio in London ahead of her trip to Australia in March as part of the author tour for her new book of essays called Dead and Alive. In that book, Zadie writes that she's always been aware of being an inconsistent personality, of having a lot of contradictory voices knocking around my head. This quality is what led her to becoming a novelist, beginning at the ripe old age of 24 with her debut hit, White Teeth. But it's also what makes Zadie Smith's non-fiction so interesting to read. In Dead and Alive, the subjects Zadie writes about include Black British history, paintings, politics, our online lives, and reaching midlife. And her approach in these essays is always questioning and attentive to moments of self-contradiction. The only time, in fact, that Zadie gets a little dogmatic is when it comes to the glories of Northwest London, where she grew up and where she now lives with her own family. Hi, Zadie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. You write about this part of London, Kilburn, in the northwest, with such affection. What's special about living there?
Well, you know, maybe nothing. Maybe it's just about that it's mine. I think most people feel that way about their patch of land. But I guess objectively, it almost encapsulates something that interests me. The idea that every human being is a universal case of the human being. So every human being expresses everything that is the case about humans, and yet they're all different. That combination you get in Kilburn. Everybody is radically different from each other, and yet each individual person is expressing the whole of the human condition. So that's a very lucky place to live if you're a novelist.
Well, what kind of different scenes of humanity might you encounter on a walk down Kilburn High Road?
I mean, a lot of it is not suitable for public radio. certainly extremes of poverty and extremes of wealth. That's true. Though, in fact, I find that the rich people don't go down Kilburn High Road anymore as much as they used to. They used to come just to, you know, grab something from Sainsbury's, but now they tend not to. They go the other way. But the first thing I guess you would notice is this extraordinary variety of immigrant, of you know, 50 years worth of immigration from all over the world. So you can genuinely stand on that street and meet someone from, you know, maybe 50 countries in an hour. So that's fascinating.
This is the part of the world where you started life. How does it compare now with the place you remember, the Kilburn you remember as a kid?
I don't know. I think you can speak very directly, non-metaphorically. Like, for example, at the south end of the high road, which was always the poorer part, there used to be a kind of mixed-use public building above the market where my mother ran a drop-in group for poor kids, basically. Kids whose parents weren't at home, kids who had nowhere to go, a kind of unofficial youth club, which I used to attend as well just because there was no one to look after me as she was doing that. And that is demolished and gone, and it's meant to be turning into some kind of mall, but the mall is half built and may never be finished. And so what you see is a lot of increased poverty. It was never rich, but it used to have a series of safety nets and possibilities for people, spaces where they could be free spaces. There used to be a bookshop, which is crazy to think of now. Just right there by my mother's youth club, there was a bookshop in Kilburn High Road, which people would visit. Now, not only is there not a bookshop, there's not a W.H. Smith. And W.H. Smith was from Kilburn. He was a Victorian from Kilburn. But so even his W.H. Smith is gone. So a kind of hollowing out. Yeah, but it's the same all over the world, right? So the shops that are left are the ones which either deal with you directly as a human, hair cutting, Chinese medicine, or kind of enormous chain stores.
Why had your parents chosen this part of London to live in?
Because it was cheap. also, back in the day, Kilburn was kind of famous for the Irish and the Jamaicans, and both of those communities are in my family, and so it was a kind of familiar place to be. You knew where you were.
How had your mum and dad met one another, Zadie?
It's not a very edifying story because there's such a big age gap between them, as 30 years. My understanding is that my father, quite as it is in Whiteteith, met my mother at a party. He'd gone to pick up his own daughter. So one of those delightful tales.
What would she have looked like when they first met, your mum?
She was extremely beautiful. She did a bit of modelling later, a few years later. What did she look like? She was, in Jamaican terms, we would call her Margot, which is not a compliment. It means skinny, which is not a value in Jamaica, particularly at that time. She was skinny, very, very dark, which was also not particularly a value in Jamaica at that time. So sometimes she had a hard time. And bald, like kind of a very short head of hair. A short afro, yeah.
And gorgeous, I see it. I see that,
yeah,
amazing
very good
combo.
Looking.
Did she maintain that kind of glamour after she became a mum?
I mean, my mum is, she's now, well, I shouldn't say her age, but she's not that much older than me, so there's that. And she definitely looks about 20 years younger than me, so
that's
she's
gonna
fine.
Hurt.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about my mother.
So, as you say, your mum was born in Jamaica. What kind of stories did she tell you about what life had been like for her there, what her childhood was like?
I mean, we went back, so, I could see it as well. I guess we have a difference. Like, she would say, and she's correct, that she would not like to be described as poor because she felt, particularly she's brought up by her grandparents, that she was given a lot of love by them, and that's a kind of idyll in her mind. But, you know, objectively, they were extremely poor, yeah. And, you know, it was tough for my mum because her mother had left to come and work in England and she didn't know her father. So it's hard to be an unparented child.
Did London offer opportunities to her then when she came here? Did it feel like that kind of place to her?
I don't really think so, no. I mean, it was freezing. She'd been without a mother for 10 years by the time she turned up. You know, it's my mother's story to tell, not mine. But it was not easy, and there was no intention of sending her to school, for example. So a lot of the things that my mother did, she had to do by herself.
And your dad had a very different kind of background, was much older than your mum. He'd served in the Second World War. Was that something he spoke to you about?
No, not when we were kids. That's such a boring cliche. They never spoke about the war, but unfortunately, that is the case. And I didn't even know that he had liberated the Belsen concentration camp till I was in my 30s. So it's partly my fault. I just never asked. You know, but to the generation in the 80s, it was a kind of, it was a kind of horror. Like, around 12, I learned about the Nazi death camps and slavery. And those two things were like the ghosts in the cupboard, you know, they were almost too awful to think about. So I don't think I asked very much.
What about books in your childhood? What kind of place did they have?
Well, they were my entire childhood. In fact, a very strange thing just happened, that I just saw a man called Michael Rosen walk past this radio window. And when I was 9, I won a creative writing competition that he had set, and he gave me the prize. He probably doesn't remember that, but I might go and find him afterwards. So
he's
that
a famous children's book
childhood.
Writer in
the famous children's
in
book
UK.
Writer. And at that time, I don't know why he was the judge of this prize, but I won the first prize. There's a photo in my mum's kitchen of me with him.
Well, all things come full circle. I'm glad that this you're in the BBC for this moment then.
How strange. So that was my childhood. A lot of reading, and because my parents had such a, it was such a terrible atmosphere in the house, I guess, like a lot of writers, I I chose books over reality in order to just get away from the situation.
Was it libraries that you went to, or where would you get your books from?
No, my parents were really good about getting books. They both, because they hadn't really been educated, had a great aspirations to be educated, and it was full of books. There were books everywhere in our flat. Wherever we lived, there were books everywhere.
And did you have free rein?
Yeah, there was. It's a bit like kids with Netflix today. There's nobody saying, don't watch that thing about Jeffrey Dahmer. And similarly, in my house, there was no one saying, you probably shouldn't read whatever it was, The Color Purple or Kafka. There was no age limit on this stuff.
You've got a fantastic essay in the new book on the English painter Celia Paul, and it explores her depiction of the creativity, which for her, in her case, was this intensely competitive creativity of her own girlhood. Is that something you relate to in your own life?
I think, you know, I grew up in a feminist household, and so I was entirely aware of the issues facing women's expression and women's creativity, to the point I was reading all my mother's completely inappropriate for an 8-year-old, you know, feminist, separatist, lesbian text published in California in the late 70s, Andrea Dworkin and all. I was reading all that stuff as a small kid, but nothing prepares you really for turning 12 and losing the happy, genderless, joyful sight of childhood. It doesn't matter how many feminist texts you read, it's still a punch to the gut when it happens.
For you, was part of that, you know, blissful pre-12-year-old life, was that about being a creative person too? Like, were you writing stories as well as reading them?
To me, see, I don't think of it that way. To me, reading is creative. I did very little writing, really, in my childhood. I did some. Every now and then I'd do some. But much more creative was all the reading. That's the source of my creativity, and it is the creative part of me, reading. Not writing is just an outcrop of that.
What about TV, Zadie? How much TV did you watch as a kid?
You know, I love television, and I loved television, and I was that generation. I grew up on it, and you know, when you have working parents too, it's just that is your home. Coming home every day and switching on immediately and watching it for as long as possible. I also think there is something when you are a minority in a culture. Watching the majority television is like trying to work out what's going on here. What is this country? I think that's true for everybody. I think children watch television for that purpose, partly to work out what the world is and what's going on. But it's doubled when you are a minority within a majority culture. Then you're looking for more than just what's going on. You're looking for signs of what your place is in all of this. So I think I watch TV in that spirit a lot.
Which shows were the most helpful kind of anthropological guides then?
I mean, you know, playing spot the black person on television in England in the 70s and 80s was what we all did, but it was, you know, it was pretty slim pickings. Mm. So, and some of what you got was not, you know, not the greatest and wasn't particularly cheering. But there were people, there was a character in a show called Rising Damp. It was, I can't remember his name, shamefully. I'm sure there'll be Brit Australians and people over 50 screaming at the radio. But he was this incredibly posh black guy. I think he was an out-of-work actor. Part of the thing was he was subject to various racist jokes from the other characters, but he had this kind of inner dignity and superiority to all of them, which was extremely comic. And I loved him. Things like that. But a lot of it was American television. You know, if you wanted to see black people in action doing things which weren't solely demeaning, then it was American TV that I liked.
You have got from an early age a great love of tap dancing that's made it into novels, particularly Swing Time. How did you get into tap dancing as a kid, which sort of seems the wrong generation in some sense?
I think everything about me is the wrong generation because I'm born in 1975, but my dad was born in 1925. Mm. He's the same age as the Queen. So it was a generational gap, and then my mother's only 20 years older than me. So that's an extreme circumstance. So half of my influences were, you know, half I'm growing up with someone who's practically my sister, and we have the same tastes and the same in music and clothes and all of that stuff. And at the other end, I have someone who, you know, saw Casablanca in the cinema, saw Ella Fitzgerald sing on the Kilburn High Road. So it was that kind of gap. And I actually, looking back, I don't think my father did love old movies, musicals, old Hollywood. I don't think he did. He wasn't particularly interested in that. It's just that I was interested because it seemed close to him, to his period. But I don't really know. At that time on Channel 4 particularly, if you woke up early in the morning or came back from school early, they played movies from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s on a loop. And I just love those movies. I particularly love movie musicals.
What did you love about tap dancing in particular?
I mean, later on in life, you know, I had all kinds of intellectual explanations. It is supposedly the art of the Irish and the blacks on slave ships, right? That's the theory behind the root of it, that it was Irish navvies and West Africans sometimes meeting on deck and exchanging moves, basically, which is a nice, neat explanation. But I think those musicals of the 30s and 40s particularly, which often involve tap dancing, what I like about them, certainly their campness, I know that's part of it, but that they are total works of art. They involve everything. I know they're not in particularly good taste, but good taste is something I find quite annoying in art practice. But everything is involved. You have to be more than a triple threat. These people sang, danced, act, were funny. The sets are made by hand and they're complete. It's, I guess, the same reason people like opera. It's engaging every sense that you have. And tap dancing is so rhythmical, so enjoyable to watch and listen to and do. And for me, the people who mattered most to me, I guess, Fred Astaire above all, I just wanted to be like that. I wanted to be very good at something and also make it look easy.
And was it when you took classes, was it a skill you had a knack for?
I was good, but I was always a better singer. So if I was doing exams and stuff, I'd always try and get around it by tap dancing less and singing more, you know. But that's true of those old MGM stars. You play to your strengths. Like Fred Astaire couldn't really sing, but he was a hell of a dancer. Gene Kelly couldn't. Well, he could kind of sing, but, you know, you work around what you've got. So that's the principle of a song and dance man.
What kind of cachet did being into tap dancing have for you at high school?
I don't know what the situation would have been in
Northwest London, but it wouldn't have been great in Australia, I don't think.
There was no cachet, but I don't feel like in my school, because of the intense diversity, I guess a bit like an American public high school, of course there are jocks, I guess, and people who are cool because they play sports. Though actually in England, that's not really a thing, not in comprehensive schools. And my group of friends were certainly, you know, freaks, but there was some cachet in being a freak in the 90s. I don't remember feeling particularly bullied or strange. It was as if there was a space for each group, and we had our own space. And within that, I was fine, I think.
In one of the pieces included in Dead and Alive, you describe falling out of an upstairs window as a teenager. What happened?
Well, I was smoking. You know, I guess I was a nerdy student, but that didn't preclude in the 90s, you know, drinking a lot, smoking a lot, taking a lot of drugs. We all did that. And I've been smoking since I was 12. And I was trying to stop, but not very hard. But I was definitely trying to hide it from my mother. And so I was smoking on a windowsill so she couldn't smell it. And I basically fell off, yeah.
Did people see you fall? I mean, this could have ended disastrously.
Yeah, no, I should have died, really, I guess. My brothers saw it through the window. I think they saw me go by, at least. And my neighbour, a Pakistani woman who didn't really speak English, she came out and I think she must maybe called the ambulance, though I'm not sure how. Like, it was hard to communicate with her, but she was there and was sympathetic, and I don't know what I don't know why I didn't die. It's a height, you know, it's the top of a house. I just got extremely lucky.
And what kind of, you know, rehab did you have to have after that fall?
I mean, it was complicated by the fact that I was, now I'm such an exercise addict, but up till my late 20s, I really did not participate in physical activity of any kind. I didn't move. I didn't like to move. And I just had no interest in that entire world. So it was a problem, yeah, because I didn't even enjoy walking. So I ignored all the physio. I didn't really do anything. I still have a limp because of it, because I did so little rehab. I just remember being on crutches for a very long time because of the lack of effort. I went straight back to all my various habits. And
even the smoking?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's very recently that I gave up smoking. Finally. I just carried on. I was very, stubborn. I just liked to do what I liked to do. That was the problem.
So how were you imagining your future back then at the kind of end of high school period of your life?
It's hard to reconstruct now. I think there's a great advantage in having the kind of parents I have, who have no expectations, no particular plans for you, because they have no models themselves. That's an underrated virtue in parents. I'm the opposite kind of parent. I've got all kinds of, you know, oppressive ideas, which my children find intolerable. I don't remember my parents ever saying, you should do this or you should do that or anything. They were unaware. They had never been to college. They didn't know what was going on. They had no idea what I was doing. They, like, in my GCSEs and A-levels, they had absolutely zero involvement. So it was all just open. So to me, it felt like anything was possible. And I think my brothers felt that too. I mean, I think if you'd asked my brothers around 18 what you're going to be, they would have said, we're going to be rap superstars. And they would have said it absolutely sincerely, with no doubt at all, and no worries about that. It was that kind of childhood. It was like an absence of control, but in a good way.
So what made you decide to apply for Cambridge?
It didn't even exist in my reality, but there was a kid in my school who became a friend, and his parents were middle-class educated people, and the father was a genius. He was a math genius, and he was a professor at All Souls, which is the one college in Oxford where you don't have to teach. You just sit around having your ideas about things. Crazy system. And I used to go around to the house all the time, and he was the one who said, you know, you could apply to one of these places. You're bright. And it really wouldn't have happened without him. He not only suggested it, he also coached me in what an interview would be like. What happens to a lot of working class kids back then, I think, hope it's a little bit different now, but when they went for these interviews at universities, they literally, why would they know anything about how to talk, the culture, what is desired, particularly at Cambridge, where this kind of slightly ironical, we don't want the facts, we want to see how you think, not what you think, but all this nonsense. Why would you know any of that? Yeah, it's a code. It's a cultural code. It's a class code. It's an intellectual principle, but it's not one that you would ever know about unless somebody had explained it to you. It's not one the teachers in our schools would know about. Our teachers didn't go to these places. I had one teacher, a blessed man, who had been to Cambridge, who was my English teacher. So he gave me a few hints as well. But it was an extremely improbable thing. But the thing which made it possible is that it was free. So, you know, that's the big... Everything I'm saying now to a young English person would sound like insanity. But back in the day, what you were told was, if you can jump through this hoop, if you can get through this 15-minute interview, we will pay for it all. And that's what happened to me. Not only was it free, university was free, but I didn't pay for my accommodation because we were below the threshold, so the council paid for that. So that's, you know, that does focus your mind. I thought, okay, maybe I can do this.
If it's not going to be a rap superstar, okay, I'll think about this. So once you arrived, what kind of culture shock was it?
I mean, it was pretty extreme. But But I was, again, you know, lucky in that my particular college, King's College, which was called the Red College, the Communist College, or it had this reputation. And in those days, it was the one that let state school kids in, which is why I had applied. So if I'd gone to Trinity, if I'd gone to John's, these other very aristocratic colleges, I think it would have been a lot harder. And if you talk to someone like the actress Naomi Harris, who's one of the few other black women at Cambridge at that time, she had a really hard time. You know, it definitely wasn't easy, but King's was much more familiar. It had state school kids. It had a lot of North London kids, private school kids, but I had seen them around. I knew who they were. And then a lot of Northern working class kids who were the most exotic to me, perhaps even more exotic than the aristocrats. I'd never been north of Cambridge. I'd never seen any of these places. So meeting people from Leeds, Bolton, Manchester, Bolton. Birmingham, all of it was to me fascinating. And all those guys tended to be mathematicians and scientists. They got on purely on, you know, their incredible brains from these schools all over the country. So there were lots of different kinds of strangeness, but being black was not the only strangeness. Those working class kids from the north were also in deep shock, I think deeper shock almost.
How many black authors did you read as part of your course at Cambridge?
I don't believe I read one. I can't remember ever being set one. But in my life, because of my mother and my flat, I'd read a lot of black authors. So I don't, you know, I never, it's a different, I guess, a different attitude now, but I wasn't looking for Cambridge to, like, heal my soul. I was looking for Cambridge to educate me. And it did do that, but I also had other ways of educating myself, you know. So it wasn't, I didn't feel a lack particularly because I already had myself, you know, my knowledge, the books I loved, my culture, my people. I didn't come with that anxiety. But yes, it was a narrow, where you look at it, it was an incredibly narrow reading list. It was deep in the sense it went back a long way, but it was, never mind no black authors, also, you know, very narrow on European writing,
women,
Asian writing, forget about it. Well, women, there's a Victorian, so there's quite a lot of women in the traditional Cambridge course. But yeah, it was narrow in the sense of its vision of literature. But then, again, in each college, a different emphasis. And in our college, it happened that our professors were interested in French philosophy. So I was reading a lot of Derrida, who's the kind of Algerian deconstructionist. So it just depended where you were. Like when I talked to my husband, who was at a different college within Cambridge, we had completely different experiences, different reading lists, different everything. So it was very particular. It depended.
So it was in that environment that you began writing the novel that became White Teeth. Was it kind of freeing in a way to be writing this book very different from any book you might have been studying? Did it give you kind of an open road to write the kind of book you wanted?
I don't know. I had a kind of strange relationship with ambition in that I wanted to do big things, but I wasn't willing to push in any direction. So I think in my second year, I sent one story to this thing called, I can't remember what it's called, New British Stories or something. It was an opportunity for unpublished people to be published. And I got a rejection letter. It was a nice one. And so in my attitude was then, okay, forget it. That was immediately my attitude.
I
was just like, I tried, I failed. So I wanted to be an academic. So I was like, I'll stay here. I loved college. I wanted to do an MPhil and I'll just be an academic. I was good with that. I was kind of excited to do that. But in my third year, a story that I'd published in a college publication somehow found itself in the hands of a editor in London. And he wrote me a letter saying, this was good. Are you working on anything longer? And that's what started me writing White Teeth. Literally, someone had to come to me and say, would you like to be published?
Make a personal request.
Yeah, because I so admire people who fight and fight and fight and send multiple stories, but I didn't have it in me. I was too easily discouraged, you know? I really felt It's the same way with singing. You know, if I couldn't do it to the right standard, then forget it. That was very much my attitude. It's a bad attitude. It's a perfectionist attitude.
It feels a very Gen X attitude, to be
honest.
Yeah,
it's very Gen X. And it's very self-punishing. It's like, you know, if I can't be Aretha Franklin, forget it. And if I can't be... It was totally that. And also, yeah, no ambition. Like, it's not quite fair to Gen X because we were so passionate about culture and about art. It was just about the business side of it. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't... My father had said to me once in his kind of beatnik 50s hat on, don't ever be a salesman. There's nothing worse than being a salesman. Mm-hmm. And that's how I felt. I'm not proud of that feeling, but that's how it was. I didn't want to sell anything to anyone. I didn't want to convince anyone of anything. So I started White Teeth because somebody requested it. Yeah. And then as I was writing it, it was a great relief from the exams. It was like an enjoyment. Yeah.
It came out. I mean, I remember when it came out, the amount of attention and excitement and focus on you as a still really young person. How do you look back at that moment in your life now?
I mean, sometimes I think I always try and contact young writers when I see it happening to them. It's like a PTSD response. So like when Sally Rooney blew up, I remember thinking I must write to this person and make sure she's okay. Sally Rooney is fine, by the way. Fine.
What would you say to someone who is in that situation like you found yourself in? What's the wisdom of hindsight?
Well, I would say what I said to Sally, which Sally did not need saying, which is just stay at your desk and do your work and ignore it. But no one needs to tell Sally Rooney that. She knew that from birth. But it's a hard thing to remember. And also it's so different. Like, however hard I found it, I was just pre-internet, really, right? So there were some blogs which hurt my heart, but blogs? I mean, come on. Now it's a completely different scenario for a young writer. It must be so hard. And I'm not the one to advise them because I never went through what they go through.
A few of the essays in Dead and Alive return to the trope of the art monster, you know, this artist who's completely selfish when it comes to their work and willing to sacrifice anyone or anything to it. It's, you know, conventionally a male figure, but you write about a few female ones, both historical and fictional. Was that kind of steely-minded sacrifice of other lives to your writing, your art, ever something that you felt you had to make? Was that ever a bargain that seemed on your plate?
You know, I really don't want to be an art monster. That's the best way I can put it. If I am one, I'm sorry. I've tried my best to, you know, keep relations with the people I love, to raise a family, to be a decent friend, and to try and just act like anybody else with a job, which is how I think about it. But it's definitely the case that it's deeply distracting writing. Your mind is often somewhere else, and I think that's painful for the people around you. But I don't consider that some kind of great virtue, like I guess the generation above me was so proud of all the ways they hurt people and dedicated themselves to their art. I'm not at all interested in that dynamic.
There's also, I guess, the presumption with that family life, or, you know, certainly motherhood, parenthood, is somehow inimical to art. Like, I get time. That's a reality that's hard to...
Yeah, the time part is practical, but the experiential part is just a nonsense. I mean, it has been really the joy of my life to see what women have done with literature. Mm-hmm. Since the invention of partners who also take care of children and childcare and, you know, women's liberation, essentially, which is, you know, so new. People forget, but this is a radically new scenario that you don't have to have 11 children because you have no way of controlling it. Or this is new, this time and space. And, you know, literature has been widened and broadened in ways that are so extraordinary. And for the first time, like, I think that request of Freud or of Simone de Beauvoir, like, what are women and what do women want? Well, we get to hear for the first time in human history. It's a miracle.
And part of that change, that widening, is acknowledgement of all the benefits that being embedded in a kind of domestic world can have, that those aren't just things that take away from an artistic life but can nourish it, nurture it in ways.
Right. I mean, I personally, like, it is essentially a kind of neoliberal idea to believe that motherhood is nothing but something that takes freedom from you. That is, to me, that's not what Indigenous people feel. It's not what radical feminism feels, actually. So I personally get bored of reading the endless... it's like a genre of book about how horrific it is to have a child and how it's the antithesis of all creation. And it is creation. It is a creative act. And it involves an extraordinary amount of creativity every day. There are plenty of parents, fathers and mothers who will tell you that, how much ingenuity, how much thinking on your feet, how much storytelling, how much energy it takes to raise a child. That is a creative act. So to me, it's not the opposite of what I do. It's enriched what I do enormously.
Your kids are teenagers now, and I guess the massive difference for people our age with teenagers is we remember what life was like before smartphones, before we became enveloped in this online world. And this is something that you write about with so much insight in Dead and Alive. You don't use a smartphone, Zadie. So tell me, what's catching a train like for you these days?
I feel anxious talking about these things. I wrote that essay. That is the last essay I'll be writing on the internet. I am done.
Really?
Yeah,
why,
absolutely.
Why is that?
What more is there to say? I feel, you know, that loneliness I feel on a train where everybody's elsewhere. I feel some mild vindication, which is not a feeling. Vindication is not a particularly enjoyable feeling for me. But I've been writing about this since, I think, my Facebook essay is 2010, where I wrote that and then sat around being called a Luddite and putting up with a lot of being told I'm absurd and ridiculous and this and that. And that was a critique of Facebook. It's hard to remember the days when most people thought Facebook was terrific. So it's been a long, like, boring. It's been boring. It's boring to say these things and be called a Luddite over and over again. It's got nothing, and try to explain over and over again, this is not an anti-technology argument. And by the way, you are not interacting with technology. You are interacting with a behavior modification system. This is not the same as being tech savvy. So, but now I feel so much happier because these arguments are so over. Like, everybody knows this now. Like, I don't have to make any case because everybody is fully aware of what this is, from the 9-year-olds to the 99-year-olds. So now it's just a matter of what you want to do in public policy, what you want to do individually, what you want to do structurally, who you want to see in prison. That's a bit for a society to decide together. But the actual fundamental case, which was so hard to make, is now common knowledge to the point of tedium. I'm sad for all the people who got caught in the crosshairs of it, some of whom actually died. Many of those people were very young. I'm very, very sad that that had to happen and that so many people's earliest experiences of the world were so tainted by a few utterly corrupt billionaires. That is a great shame, a great human shame.
You know, you're right that there's definitely more widespread awareness about the dangers of the way we're living online and what impact that has on our brains, our privacy, our self-esteem, especially for kids and teenagers. But you've managed to keep this digital world at a distance to some degree by never using a smartphone, while many people are still enmeshed in it, even while being increasingly critical of it. But in what ways has your loyalty to the book and the technology of the book kind of burst forth? I mean, that's something that comes across for me in your essays, is this thing that we just take for granted. What an amazing piece of technology the book is. How freeing it is.
It's an incredible piece of technology. I mean, what I want to say first about those people still enmeshed is that it's terrible to put a moral weight on them. I feel the same way about heroin addicts. That's not a sin. Heroin is extremely addictive. It's extremely addictive. So it is no surprise when it takes over somebody's existence. It's not a moral question. That's a structural and practical question. So I always try and nudge the argument away from that towards the actual source of this product. And I also think the limitations of the addiction metaphor are there. I think it's a bit more like getting to the edge of kind of Alice's rabbit hole and falling in. I think it is possible to come back out again. I think it is possible. It's possible to make that rabbit hole a kind of side issue in your life and not your whole life. There are techniques. It's just not easy. And it's been made more difficult by these tech companies who try to thwart any possibility of a reasonable relation to these things at the start. Mm. There was never a chance of a reasonable relationship. And there should be a chance of it because there's so many joyful experiences to be had online that people have a right to and should be allowed to enjoy. So that's that first. But books, you know, I thought until about 2016, I would have said, you know, people in my line of work, it's just we're deeply irrelevant and it's fine. We have like a little thing that we do in this corner of the culture and it doesn't matter. That's how I felt. But then watching what happened from 2016 to now, discourse, which I thought was just a thing that happened in my house and in universities, to see discourse take over the world, utilized as a weapon at the highest levels of government, has been so clarifying. Because I always thought, oh, the people in power, they don't really care about these, you know, classroom arguments about history or woke this, or they can't possibly, that's not serious. What they're really running is an economic, they're big people, they're dealing with an economic and political situation. No, this is genuinely what's in their minds. So when you know that, then it becomes really important language, because we are the professionals with language. And if people with power are going to take discourse this seriously as their motivating force, then the counterweight becomes equally important. And that's what Orwell knew. It really does matter. Orwell's novels really do matter. Orwell's speeches really do matter. They're still mattering. They're still a technology that can be used to break open the kind of non-speak and dangerous speech that's happening at the highest levels of power. So to me, it's a lesson. I really thought I was in a dilettante's business, but now I see that if the war is being waged with language, then those of us who have some rhetorical abilities also are part of the war.
Mm. There's that aspect, and then there's also the aspect of what a book is to hold in a reader's hands, and it being that thing that, like you were describing as a little kid, wandering around your parents' house and picking up and putting down what interested you, with nothing tracking you and nothing being able to sell you something based on your previous interest in this story or that author. But the freedom of self-creation through choosing a way of reading is still entirely open for anyone who wants to pick up a book.
It's open. And it's, I mean, I'm speaking as a reader here, not as a writer. Like on the way here in the cab, I had the little cab light on. I was risking car sickness to read Edward P. Jones's The Known World again. And reading that book, I mean, that book is a masterpiece.
I don't know it. But can you say something about it?
It's about slavery in America in a made-up county called Manchester County. It won all the prizes a long time ago, about 25 years ago. He's a very brilliant man, and the world is so real and so fascinating and so complicated, because one of the things he's dealing with is the reality of black slave owners, of which there were some. And he's talking about that world of white and black slave owners in the same county. This is an incredible novel, challenging, provocative, humane. And as you're reading it, as I'm reading it, I'm always remembering, oh, this is what the fight is for. The fight is for these things called human beings. It's so easy, you know, when you're in the other kind of discourse, to wake up every morning and think, what is this? These are trash people. Why would I want to fight for this human trash who are worth nothing, who do nothing, who only kill, who only maim, who are disgusting? that is an attitude many people have, and it's easy to get when you're living inside a certain discourse. But when you're in Edward P. Jones's novel, it's not possible. It's not possible not to believe that every single human being in front of you is sacred, a case of the universal, and in need of your help.
You turned 50 last year, Zadie. What's the most interesting thing about this stage of life for you?
I don't know. I was a bit childish about it. Kind of threw all my toys out of the pram early in the year and had a long 8-month sulk.
What about time? How dare it be happening?
Yeah, just always like, I can't, what are you talking about? Like a friend of mine, her father was in the paper, not because he's a celebrity, it was just a news report about something in his life, and it said his daughter, Hannah, brackets 50, and Hannah was like, who are they talking about? And they're talking about you, Hannah, and they're talking about me, brackets 50. I don't know how that has happened, but it's happened. So here we are. It's okay. I mean, the lesson is that you can't believe how quickly it comes up and how strange it is. And then you have to start behaving, presumably, in a way that feels appropriate. I don't know what that would involve, but I'm trying to work it out.
I mean, when you write about the younger Zadie, it feels like there was a lot of eye rolling that she engaged in. And that's not really an appropriate attitude in midlife, I don't think.
You've got to be on the side of life. Yeah, you've got awe, you've got to, I mean, not to the point of weak-mindedness, no. I think that is a real challenge for the middle-aged artist, is that awe is delightful. And honestly, it's one of the experiences I have most often, certainly in the natural world or even in the streets of my neighbourhood. But it's not a very useful fictional feeling. At least you have to work for it. And the kind of clear-eyedness and non-sentimentality has to be combined with the awe. But humour is useful for that, you know, finding things funny.
Mm. But I like that you've got to be on the side of life from 50 on, that registers.
Absolutely. On the side of the young, on the side of change, on the side of revolution even. You can't shut down.
You've got a really lovely foreword to the collection that you call On Hospitality. What does that mean for you, for a writer to be hospitable?
This is not the view of a lot of writers, I think. A lot of writers feel they are writing to a particular group of people or particular kind of person and they want to speak directly to them, their community. I get it. I just don't feel that way. I don't feel that way. I'm writing for everybody. Not because I want to sell the most books, but because that's a political principle in my eye and an aesthetic principle. I think there is a way of writing that is not dumbed down, that is not sentimental or simplified, but has respect for every reader who walks into your house of words. It's open to them. Even people who you might abhor personally or politically in real life, the door has to be open. What they do after that is their business, but I'm not there to shut the possibility of conversation down. That's not my role. It's many other people's role, and good luck to them. And I'm sure it's much chicer, right? And it's cooler, and when the door is narrower, like in any modernist home, it looks better. But I'm just not that writer, and I never will be. And some of it's going to be, you know, not to your taste. That's called being alive.
Zadie, it's been such a treat to speak with you. Thank you so much for being our guest on Conversations.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Zadie Smith was my guest on Conversations. Her new book is called Dead and Alive, and she's coming to Australia in March, including an appearance at the Sydney Opera House on March the 8th. This conversation was recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.